This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
My guests are Paul Schrader, who wrote and directed the new film First Reformed, and Ethan Hawke, the film's star. Schrader is best known for writing the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. And as you'll hear, First Reformed has echoes of Taxi Driver, although the setting and the main characters are quite different. In First Reformed, Ethan Hawke plays Reverend Ernst Toller, who's caught in a crisis of faith as he sinks deeper into despair and loneliness. He had been a military chaplain and convinced his son to follow the family's tradition of service and enlist. 6 months later, his son died in the Iraq War. Reverend Toller was overwhelmed by guilt. His marriage didn't survive. Toller is now the pastor of a small, historic Dutch Reformed church just outside Albany, New York, whose main function is as a tourist attraction for the few visitors passing through. The church is owned by a nearby megachurch, which is preparing a big 250th anniversary celebration for the Dutch Reformed Church. But Toller is sick in both body and spirit, and not doing what is expected of him for the celebration. Early in the film, one of the small church's few congregants asks to speak with Reverend Toller. She's pregnant, and her husband Michael, an environmental radical activist, wants her to have an abortion because he doesn't want to bring a child into this world, knowing that by the time the child is grown, the earth will be irreparably damaged, perhaps even unlivable. She's worried about her husband's depression and asks Reverend Toller to speak with him. In this scene, Reverend Toller tries to convince Michael that his suffering isn't just about the environment, it's also about his inner despair and depression. Michael is played by Philip Ettinger. The Reverend is played by Ethan Hawke. He speaks first.
Courage is the solution to despair. Reason provides no answers. I can't know what the future will bring. We have to choose despite uncertainty. Wisdom is holding two contradictory truths in our mind simultaneously. Hope and despair. A life without despair is a life without hope. Holding these two ideas in our head is life itself.
Are you drinking, man, Reverend?
It doesn't help.
No, I suppose not. Can God forgive us for what we've done to this world?
I don't know. Who can know the mind of God? But we can choose a righteous life, belief, forgiveness, grace covers us all. I believe that.
Ethan Hawke, Paul Schrader, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on this film. I really love this film. Thank you for making it. So, you know, in the dialogue that we heard, I think it's fair to say that the Reverend is trying to convince himself as much as he's trying to convince Michael. The movie is so much about living with hope and despair and whether faith can enable you to deal with despair and what happens if despair starts to win. Paul Schrader, what was the kernel of the idea for this film? What came to you first? Was it the idea of dealing with the environmental crisis or the crisis of faith?
Ironically, Terry, the kernel was an intellectual decision. I had, as a young man, as a film critic, written about spiritual films, but claimed that I would never make one. It wasn't me. It wasn't what I wanted to do. I liked those films, but I didn't want to make one. And then about 3 years ago, after a conversation, I said, it's time now. You're going to be 70 next year. It's time to write a spiritual script, not only in a time of my life, but also in the life of this planet. And so once I made the intellectual decision to go there, to the place where I swore I would never go, then things started to fall in, and the various pieces, the lone man in his room, the despair we all feel over the environmental crisis, the need to do something, even if it's destructive, those pieces started to fall in.
Why were you so opposed to making a spiritual movie in the past, and what made this time in your life the right time?
Well, you know, as a young man, I was intoxicated by action and empathy and sex and violence. And these are not in the Transcendental Toolkit. And I didn't want to step away from them. And also, 30 years ago or so, the cost of film making was more prohibitive than it is now. So making a film like this today is financially responsible in a way it wasn't 30 years ago.
But, I mean, you were a religious young man. You grew up in the Dutch Reformed Church. You proselytized when you were young. But I guess when you left the church, you really left it. You went to the other side.
Well, you have to. You know, the only way you get out of an environment like that is the way a bullet gets out of a gun. And so there's a lot of impetus. You know, I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the Christian Reformed Church there. And if you don't get out fast and furiously, you get about as far as Kalamazoo and they pull you back.
Were there memories you drew on for this movie?
Put it this way, I didn't have to do much research. And I was surprised the number of biblical texts that just came to mind. You know, as a young person, you do Bible study and you memorize verses after verse. But then, you know, 40 years later, you figure they're all gone, and suddenly you're sitting there and a verse comes to mind.
What were the pastors like who you knew?
I do remember a couple episodes where I did go to the parsonage, you know, with counseling. And they were always very considerate and generous. Because, you know, for a lot of Americans, the pastor is the stand-in for the therapist. You know, they don't go to a therapist. They don't go to a psychiatrist. So where do you go? Well, you go to your pastor and say, look, I'm having these problems. What should I do?
Did you go to your pastor for advice on things?
Well, just, you know, when you feel that, you know, whether it is parental or some kind of other thing that's eating you up, you know, you need to tell somebody. And oftentimes that person is not your parent.
So what would you tell your pastor that you wouldn't tell your parents?
Just the anger you feel. And that was an issue for me as a young man, just wanting to do something. An explosion. The line in Taxi Driver all those years ago where Travis Bickle says, I just want to go out and do something, which means, you know, this urge is becoming violent. And so that's one thing you talk about.
Is that something you feel you've carried around with you all your life, that anger and the urge to do something?
Yes. You know, it modifies over the years. But in this film, it comes out again.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
And this film has been compared to Taxi Driver, I think rightly so, except that the taxi driver is essentially an ignorant person, and Reverend Toller is an intellectual, and there's 40 years between them. So it's not the same movie.
Ethan Hawke, I want to bring you into the conversation and start by saying your performance is so incredible in this. When you read the script, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of screenplays you get that you decide not to do, and you probably see screenplays of every level of quality. What did you love about the screenplay? I would like to think that if I read the screenplay, I would know how good it is. I'm not very good at reading screenplays because I feel like I need to see what's going on too, but could you tell right away how good this was going to be?
The short answer to your question is yes. But screenplays are, it's a funny art. And often one of the things that you find out when you come to set is that one person was imagining a different movie than the other person was imagining because the screenplay itself was so vague and that we all project the movie we most want to see. And Paul's screenplay was extremely specific. It was the opposite of vague. But it also felt like he was giving voice to something that was on my mind, you know? It's like there's something about Reverend Toler that to me was like a scream, you know, just some kind of a roar. I don't know what to say, but I felt it immediately and without any confusion.
What was that thing that was on your mind that the movie articulated?
A question. A question, I think, that how to be a grown-up. Where are the grown-ups? Who's leading? Am I supposed to lead? What am I supposed to do? Why am I here? Why was I born? Why do bad things have to happen all the time? And, you know, it's like these are very obvious questions that are always being asked, but they're set in a way that gave them meaning and clarity for me anyway. It made me want to play the part.
Paul Schrader, how did you cast Ethan Hawke in the role? What made you think of him?
Well, usually as a writer, you try not to think of actors because, one, you're not going to get them, and two, it makes you lazy as a writer because you start hearing their voice instead of yours. But about halfway through this script, I started thinking about this guy, and there's a certain physiognomy that goes with characters we associate with the clergy, and like Montgomery Clift and I Confess, or Claude Ledoux and Country Priest, or Belmondo and Pierre Morin. So now I started thinking about American actors who had that kind of look. And so you start thinking Jake Gyllenhaal or Oscar Isaac or Ethan Hawke. And Ethan, you know, had 10 years on The Other Guys, and he was just coming to a very interesting place in his physical life. By that I just mean the physical quality of his face, that I thought, you know, I think he's the right guy right now for this. And
are you talking that he's aged to the point where
you can see a number of lessons in his face that he doesn't have to act. You know, life has put them there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent him the script, and he responded within a day. What I saw in Ethan, you know, it's not necessarily his natural personality. In real life, Ethan is kind of outgoing and friendly and sometimes a bit goofy. But I imagine what would happen if you turned all that energy inward. And so that every time he had an impulse to be casual, you know, you'd take that knife and just turn it around and bring it in. And that was essentially my only instruction to him. And because I...
Wait, the instruction really, was to every time he felt what? To take the knife and turn it in?
Every time he felt the need to be likable and outgoing and casual and friendly, to take that impulse and turn it around and thrust it inside.
And one of the first things that Paul told me, we sat down to have coffee to talk about the script, one of the first things he said to me is, you know, do you know what a recessive performance is? A lean back performance. And I did know what he was talking about. And he was talking about exactly what he's saying there, which is that we weren't going to be shucking and jiving and singing for our living, that we weren't going to be trying to entertain you. We were going to be trying to do something else, which would be to invite you into the movie. And anytime I felt the need to entertain, to not do it, to simply put that energy inside and make the audience chase us.
Ethan Hawke, you're playing a pastor in First Reformed. Did you know many pastors when you were growing up? Were you a churchgoer?
I was baptized and confirmed in Episcopal, and I had a great Reverend Gene Smith was my reverend who confirmed me, and she was a great thinker and a great teacher about a life of faith, and I realize only now how many people don't have that. She was a very supple thinker.
She was a she.
And she was a she, and to give the Episcopalians credit, I went to Trinity Church in Princeton, New Jersey, and my mother taught Sunday school, and so it's a big part of my life, you know, as a young person, We would do missionary work every summer. And
what
and
kind of missionary work did you do?
You know, we'd go down to the hollers in Kentucky and people sign up. You know, we'd build, you know, latrines and paint fences and build roofs and all through Kentucky and West Virginia and in the back hollers there. That was fun. And then one summer we went to Haiti and worked with Mother Teresa's order there in the House of the Dying.
So this was missionary work to help people not to proselytize, or was there proselytizing too?
It was just, you know, we just offered free labor.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's proselytizing by example.
Yeah, there you go. That's
but
exactly.
Paul Schrader, you proselytized by proselytizing when you were young, right? I mean, you went door to door, didn't you?
Yeah, I went through a phase where, my father was a frustrated minister. He had to drop out because of the Depression. So I was raised to fill that slot. And so it came quite naturally to go out, you know, with tracts in your hand and go door to door, give people tracts, ask them, you know, even though you're a kid.
Ask them what?
Have you met Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? You know, that's a good place to start. And, you know, it's amazing how many people will actually talk to a kid who wouldn't talk to an adult. And my mother, it's a wonderful story, because back then, a lot of people would go door to door. And so right next to the front door, she had put up a whole list of refutation texts for all of the various denominations. So if the Catholics came by, or if the Christian Scientists came by, she would have a refutation text for them. And so she would invite them in and give them coffee and then start giving them the refutation text. And then they had to find a way out. And I remember watching this. So that was kind of the environment.
What's a refutation text?
A refutation text, you know, says why you're wrong. You know, the Bible is nothing but refutation text, as we've learned. You know, you can use almost any text to counteract any other text.
So did hearing your mother refute all these other religious people coming to the door help you question your own religion instead of deepening it?
No. What made me question was just myself. I mean, you know, when you're about 16, you have to make public confession in order to take communion. And you have a class, your catechism class graduates, and you make a public profession. And I didn't feel like doing it. I had anxiety about it. I said, I don't necessarily believe all these things that I've been told. So I went to the minister and I said, you know, I'm not comfortable with it. And he said, that's fine. So the rest of the class went up and I didn't. But then every Friday at about 7 o'clock, an elder from the church would come to our home and discuss with me my questions of faith. Well, I'm 16 years old. I just got a driver's license. It's Friday night. How long can this go on? About 3 weeks of that. And I said, I'm ready to make profession.
So how old were you when you officially cut ties?
Well, I went to Calvin College. So you're still in the church system until you graduate. And then I went off to UCLA postgraduate. I thought that was the end of that period of my life. But you can run far and you can run fast, but you can't really run away from your upbringing.
Do either of you still go to church?
Oh, I was there yesterday. So I guess the answer is yes.
We're recording this on Monday, so yesterday would have been Sunday. And what kind of church do you go to now?
I'm a Presbyterian at the moment. I started out as a Calvinist, Christian Reformed, and then went over to the Episcopalians for a while, and now I ended up with the Presbyterians.
What led you to the Presbyterians?
Just because this particular church we moved, and they had a very good music program. But see, for me, I like to go to church on Sunday mornings to organize my thoughts, organize my week, and be quiet. And you don't walk out of church because you're bored, because you go to church to be bored, to have that time. And you can have it in your room in the lotus position, or you can have it in a pew. Essentially the same sort of thing for me. And that's what I enjoy about it. Now, as seen in the film First Reformed, church services have now sort of split into two camps. One is the old traditional devotional service, which is based on silence and Bible study. And the other is the arena, which is an entertainment-based performance. And I won't say one is better than the other, because there's good Christians in both. But for me, I prefer the devotional.
And Ethan Hawke, what about you? What kind of church do you go to now? If that's not too
really
personal,
go.
If it is, you don't need
feel
to answer
too
it.
Personal.
Okay.
For years, when I was first in the city, I started going to a Quaker church because I was really moved by the silence, as Paul spoke about. I really enjoyed that, and it's even funny listening to you talk about, you know, when you're 16 and having to make your public statement. I remember that Reverend Gene Smith, I had the similar problems with saying things I didn't believe, and she kind of gave me a framework of understanding a lot of the language of the Bible and a lot of the language of faith as a poem, as a spiritual poem, as a devotional poem, and that I could come up with alternate meanings to make sense of my own faith. And it's kind of something I've been doing my whole life. And I really, St. John the Divine here in New York is a beautiful Episcopal church. I like to go there. But I don't go consistently anymore. And as my kids grow up, I realize I didn't give them that. And I have some sadness about it, particularly listening to Paul speak about organizing the week and having institutionalized boredom is a great value.
Well, Paul Schrader, Ethan Hawke, thank you so much for talking with us, and thank you so much for your new movie, First Reformed.
Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.
Paul Schrader wrote and directed the new film, First Reformed. Ethan Hawke stars in the film. Here's a hymn sung in the film by a small church choir.
Are you washed?
Are you washed?
In the blood.
In the blood.
In the
soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb. Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
Are you walking daily by the Savior's side?
Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
Do you rest each moment in the crucified?
Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
Now Justin Chang has a review of a film with a completely different tone, the sequel to The Incredibles, which was a box office smash 14 years ago and won the Oscar for Best Animated Feature. The Disney-Pixar sequel, Incredibles 2, continues the superheroic adventures of Mr. Incredible, Elastigirl, and their three gifted children. It reunites the first film's writer-director, Brad Bird, with a cast led by Holly Hunter, Craig T. Nelson, and Samuel L. Jackson. Here's Justin.
Given Pixar's mixed record in the sequel department, I wasn't convinced we needed a follow-up to The Incredibles. Brad Bird's ingenious 2004 animated comedy remains one of the studio's peak achievements. A brilliant action movie, a cheeky explosion of 60s design motifs, and a deeply moving portrait of an American family coming together and becoming more than the sum of its extraordinary parts. The good news is that while Incredibles 2 may not top the original, it broadens the material and deepens the characters in ways that are by turns expected and surprising, and always deliriously entertaining. Craig T. Nelson and Holly Hunter once again lead the terrific voice cast as Bob and Helen Parr, a.k.a. Mr. Incredible, he of the superhuman physique, and Elastigirl, she of the stretchable limbs. Also back for more are Frozone, who's voiced by Samuel L. Jackson and can shoot ice from his fingertips, and Edna Mode, the diminutive fashion goddess who designs state-of-the-art superhero couture. She's voiced again, hilariously, by Bird himself. Despite the 14 intervening years, the new movie picks up right where the first one left off, with Bob and Helen confronting the Underminer, a drillin' villain who threatens to destroy their city. Longing to join the fight are their moody teenage daughter, Violet, with her powerful purple force fields, and their raucous adolescent son, Dash, with his ridiculously speedy legs. But their parents insist that they stay out of harm's way and look after their adorable baby brother, Jack-Jack. The mission doesn't go well. The bad guy escapes, the property damage is enormous, and the tide of public opinion remains firmly set against the Incredibles and their fellow superheroes, whose powers were outlawed in the first movie. Suddenly homeless and unemployed, Bob and Helen hole up in a motel and try to figure out what to do next. But a glorious second chance arrives, courtesy of two sibling entrepreneurs, sharply voiced by Bob Odenkirk and Catherine Keener. They want to make Elastigirl the face of a media campaign that will show the public all the good that superheroes do. The perks are immediate. A fancy new house for the family, and a spiffy motorcycle for Elastigirl.
A new Elasticycle?
Elasticycle? I didn't know you had a bike.
Hey, I had a mohawk. There's a lot about me you don't know.
Yeah, but a mohawk?
You didn't miss anything. Oh, yeah. This one's electric.
What's that mean?
Means it's torquey. I'll get the hang of it.
You will be great.
I will be great. And you will too.
We will both be great.
Bye, sweetie.
With Helen off completing dangerous rescue missions and becoming a media sensation, it's up to Bob to stay home and watch the kids, especially the scene-stealing Jack-Jack, whose own powers are starting to reveal themselves. Even though my own toddler has never fired laser beams from her eyes or randomly teleported into another dimension, I can attest that Incredibles 2 is one of the most ruthlessly accurate portraits of the toll of parenthood I've ever seen, in animation or live action. Bird may be a dazzling pop satirist, but he's an emotional realist at heart. The movie's spectacular climax may be a touch overextended, but Bird remains a peerless director of fluid, inventive action, and his feel for the dynamics of group combat put the Avengers movies to shame. As ever, he isn't afraid to ground his fantastical vision in real-world ideas. There are sidelong references to the dangers of screen addiction, the use of body cameras by law enforcement, the role of marketing in driving social change, and the rise of the female breadwinner in a country striving for gender parity. Holly Hunter didn't get the recognition she deserved for The Big Sick last year, and here she gives another powerhouse portrait of motherhood at its most resilient. I've never bought the fashionable dismissals of the first Incredibles as an Ayn Randian parable about defying middle-class mediocrity and harnessing one's innately superior traits. It's a reading that ignores the movie's passionate defense of creativity, humility, and public service. Bird has firmly denied any Rand connection or influence, and there are scenes and subplots in this sequel in which you can sense him determinedly setting the record straight. But if that makes Incredibles 2 sound heavy, the movie is so gorgeous and fleet and funny and touching that it never loses the thread of the story. It keeps zipping between domestic comedy and death-defying action without sacrificing dramatic stakes or emotional momentum. One minute Helen is risking life and rubbery limb to save a runaway monorail. The next Bob is trying to talk Violet through some angst involving a boy at school. Bird doesn't distinguish between big moments and small moments. Everything here matters. Like some of the best Pixar movies, from Inside Out to the Toy Story trilogy, Incredibles 2 knows that everyday life remains the grandest adventure of all.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer Michael Chabon. His new book is a collection of personal essays about being a father and a son. One of the essays went viral when it was first published in GQ. It told the story of how Chabon took his 13-year-old son to Paris Men's Fashion Week because his son loves to create his own street fashion. It turned into a surprisingly moving piece about his son finding a world he fit into. The concluding essay in the book is about Chabon's relationship with his father. Chabon's parents divorced when he was 11. Chabon won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which begins in 1939 and tells the story of two young men in the early days of the superhero craze who decide to create their own superhero. Marvel Comics and superhero movies are still among Chabon's passions. His 2007 novel, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, reimagined another chapter of history based on the premise, what if Israel collapsed in 1948 and in the wake of the Holocaust, part of Alaska was set aside as a temporary refuge for Jews? Chabon's new collection of essays is called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces. Michael Chabon, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to start with a reading from your new collection, and I want you to set it up.
Okay, well, thanks. I'm really happy to be back. And this is from the introduction to the book. And in the introduction, I open by remembering something that happened to me when I was just starting out, actually, before my first novel was published. I went to a writer's conference, and there was an older writer there who kind of took me aside and, for reasons that were not clear to me at the time, just decided to give me the benefit and sort of distill all of his wisdom into this one all-important rule that he then bestowed upon me.
So here's his advice.
Don't have children, he said. That's it. Do not. The smile faded, but its ghost lingered a moment in his blue eyes. That is the whole of the law. I was due to marry my future ex-wife in under a month. My book would come out the following spring. It turned out that this conjunction of circumstances, in the view of the famous writer, was cause for alarm. Now, marriage was fine. In fact, all of the guy's books were dedicated to his long-suffering wife. But if you were not careful, you would run a serious risk of damaging your career. After this one, he patiently explained, there would be a second novel to write. And second novels were notoriously thornier and more unwieldy than debuts. Following the inevitable sophomore screw-up, if I were lucky and stubborn in the proper measure, I would go on to tackle the magisterial third and fourth novels, then the quirky fifth, the slim and elegant sixth, the seventh, that in some way would recapitulate and ring the changes on all its predecessors, and so on, for as long as my stubbornness and luck held out. Unless, of course, I made the fatal mistake of so many would-be young hotshots before me. You can write great books, the great man continued, or you can have kids. It's up to you.
What was your reaction in the moment?
Well, first of all, I was sort of dizzied by the way he had conjured up this entire career that I could possibly have, you know, all of these subsequent books that I was going to be writing. You know, I hadn't really thought that far ahead. And, you know, since I didn't have kids yet and I wasn't even married yet and we had just sort of had a few kind of almost playful conversations, my future ex-wife and I, about having kids, it all felt so unreal to me. I didn't quite know what to make of it. But on the other hand, definitely once I began to have children and, you know, began to encounter the unquestionable difficulties that children can present to a writer trying to get his or her work done, then I had reason to remember his warning.
Okay, so you not only had like a child or children, you had four children. Mm-hmm. So how did you decide like how many to have?
The idea of having four children actually, in some ways for me, it predated my ever, being married or having children at all. And that when I grew up in Columbia, Maryland, there was this family. My best friend had three siblings. He actually had two boys and two girls in his family, which is what I ended up with my family. And this family was it was kind of a magical household to me. And I was, I would go over there. There was just always something going on in that house. There was always, a play was being written and produced, or they had gotten into taking jars to the stream behind their house and trying to catch tadpoles or whatever it might be. They did a lot of kind of collective activities as kids. And I really did create this wish in me to have that, you know, if I couldn't have it for myself, then to have it for my own children.
One of the essays in your collection, Pops, is about your son, Abe, who loves fashion, textiles, buying clothes, wearing clothes, combining garments in unusual, really fun, attention-getting ways. And for his bar mitzvah gift, when he was 13, you took him to Paris Fashion Week And you had a writing assignment from GQ to write about Fashion Week. So you took him to a lot of the shows, and, you know, he got to meet some of the designers, which was huge for him because this was so exciting to him. One of the top designers kind of singled him out for how terrifically he'd put his outfit together. Mm-hmm. So when it was time to go home, he was really unhappy about leaving and about leaving behind the people he'd met there. And you react to it. You write your reaction in this essay, at the very end of the essay. And I'd like you to read that part, and you can set it up in any way that you want to get into the reading part.
Sure. It was time for Men's Fashion Week to be over, and, you know, I expected that he was going to be a little, you know, melancholy about that. And in fact, he was very melancholy. And frankly, I had been pretty bored the whole time. You know, Men's Fashion Week didn't mean anything to me like it meant to Abe. And I was ready to go home. And, you know, I was somewhat impatiently trying to just name what exactly it was that he was feeling. So, like, yes, it's been really fun. You know, no, it's not that. Well, I know it's going to be, you know, we're sad to be leaving Paris. It's such a great place. No, it's not Paris. And, you know, I'm trying to guess or put a name to this somewhat inchoate, you know, feeling that he's having. And I kept guessing wrong. And then finally, I guessed correctly. And it was being among the people that he had been among all week, you know, fashion professionals, especially the editorial staff of GQ magazine, who had sort of been our hosts and had been really looking out for him, and he got to spend a lot of time with him. And it turned out to be, it was that group of people that he was so sorry to have to say goodbye to.
Do you want to read that excerpt?
Sure. You are born into a family, and those are your people. And they know you, and they love you. And if you are lucky, they even on occasion manage to understand you. And that ought to be enough, but it is never enough. Abe had not been dressing up, styling himself for all these years because he was trying to prove how different he was from everyone else. He did it in the hope of attracting the attention of somebody else, somewhere, someday, who was the same. He was not flying his freak flag. He was sending up a flare, hoping for rescue, for company, in the solitude of his passion. You were with your people. You found them, I said. He nodded. That's good, I said. You're early.
So what was your mix of feelings when you realized that? Because on the one hand, it's so great that your son found his people. He found the people who were as obsessed with fashion as he was. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he's like leaving the sense of family as being first and foremost his people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, it's very painful. I'm not going to lie. It's hard in your sort of deepest, most unreflective emotional mind not to see that, not to feel that as in some way a rebuke, you know, as a rejection. But it's, you know, as a parent, sooner or later, for your own sanity and for the sanity of your child, you have to realize, you have to come to terms with the fact that they are going to leave you, that they're supposed to leave you, that that's your whole mission, that's your whole purpose as a parent, ultimately, is to create a fully formed human being who can go out and stand on her own two feet. And there's a certain resemblance between what a parent feels for an adult or an almost adult child and unrequited love. It's not unrequited in the sense that your child doesn't love you back, but it's ultimately it seems to flow in this one direction, and that's the purpose of it.
So we were talking about your son finding his people at Paris Fashion Week when you took him there. When did you find your people, and who were they?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that most honest answer to that question might be it wasn't really until I started having children. And my family, my children have very much been my gang for me, at least for the, in hindsight, relatively brief period, but felt like a long time while it was happening, that we were all six together living in the same house. We were a club, and we did things as a club. We had passions, manias. obsessions as a club. And those kids, my kids, very much became my people. In some way for the first time in my life.
Did you feel like the family that you were born into was like a club for you?
No, not really. Not so much. I mean, maybe partly because there weren't enough of us. You know, there were two, mom, dad, and two kids, and my parents were divorced when I was in my very early teens, and my father moved away. You know, my father and I had a, if a club can have two members, that there was a certain degree of that in my relationship with my dad growing up. That did continue even once he moved away, to a degree, but not at all in the same degree, and in some ways still continues to this day.
I would guess that one of the things that made you feel like a club with him is that, like you, he had a passion for literature and music and comic books, so you had that to share.
Yeah, very much. And in fact, I really do feel I owe my love for those things to him and to his influence. And he didn't really distinguish between high culture and low culture, or pop culture and serious culture. I wouldn't say he loved everything, but the things he loved without real regard for whether other people consider them to be high or low. So, you know, he loves serious classical music. You know, he would introduce me to, you know, Schoenberg's music, and at the same time, you know, had me sat down to watch, you know, The Man with the X-Ray Eyes with Ray Milland, like, and to tell me, like, both of these are incredibly important things that you must know, and if you really want to earn my favor, you must also love as much as I do.
The last essay in your collection of essays, Pops, about being a father and being a son, is about your father, and he was a doctor. He's not practicing anymore, right?
No, he's not.
Yeah, and was he a general practitioner, an internist?
No, he was a pediatrician. He practiced as a pediatrician.
Oh, okay. So sometimes he took you with him.
When he was really young, and this is, I think, fairly still to this day, happens fairly often, is he would supplement his pretty meager medical student income by doing insurance physicals, like physicals for insurance companies. And when he had one of these physicals, to do, he would very often take me along with him.
And you had a toy blood pressure cuff?
Yeah, I had a whole little kit, a little plastic
little doctor bag.
Yep, with the blood pressure cuff and the candy pills, which, of course, I ate all of immediately. So I was unable to prescribe them to any of my patients thereafter.
In the essay, you compare your father's bedside manner with actual patients to his bedside manner with you, his son, when you were sick or when you were injured. And make that comparison for us.
Well, it was unquestionably the case that whatever was wrong with me, you know, he's seeing, let me set the context, he's seeing at this time what I'm writing about in this essay, and for many, many years thereafter, you know, he's seeing really sick kids. He's treating, at this time he was a doctor at the Indian Hospital, as it was called, in Phoenix, Arizona at the time, in the mid-60s. And for the rest of his career as a pediatrician, he dealt with battered children and children suffering from terrible terminal illnesses and all that kind of stuff, in addition to the garden variety fevers and diarrhea and all that kind of stuff. And, for whatever reason... my own sufferings, and, you know, thank goodness I never had any serious injuries or ailments. Nothing was ever more serious than a broken arm. I guess in some ways it just didn't measure, they didn't measure up. And so whatever I would come to him with, if I didn't feel good, if I had hurt myself, if I had cut myself, or whatever it might be, always the response from him was the same, which was, looks like we'll have to amputate. And... you know, I guess I knew he was kidding, but I was what he was serious about was, you don't seem like you're really that sick to me, and I have a much higher standard of concern than the one you are currently measuring up to. And I guess I gather from things people have told me when this piece came out, I think it was James Fallows tweeted, you know, that his father was a doctor and had very much the same kind of attitude toward his childhood injuries as my father. I don't think it's that uncommon. An experience for the children of doctors to have that sort of disregard.
Nevertheless, I thought he was being a little nonchalant, like underplaying it a little bit when you broke your arm, and he fixed it with whatchamacallit tape
Ace bandage.
With an ace bandage, yeah.
And an ice scraper.
And an ice scraper from the car. The kind of thing you'd use in a car to clean up the ice.
He was so proud of himself, too. I can still remember to this day, like, how what the...
Was that until you went to the hospital, or was that, like, that was the
No,
fix?
That was it. He said it. He put it on that.
So you're walking around with an ice scraper in your arm for how long?
For weeks? I don't remember. To be honest, I was pretty little. I was about 4 years old, and I guess it wasn't, in his judgment, a particularly serious fracture. And a splint is a splint. He splinted it, so a splint might have been this big flat piece of metal or wood that you would then possibly even use an ace bandage to do. And he didn't have a piece of flat metal or piece of flat wood, but he had this plastic ice scraper. He went and got out of the car, and that's what he used. And it's almost like a...
Were you in a remote region, like alone in the woods or something?
Yes, we were in distant Flushing, New York, in the wilds of Flushing, New York.
Okay. Did you ever talk to him about that?
Oh, yeah. He laughs about it still to this day. And like I said, he was proud. Like, he was proud of his... You know how there's this thing with con men where, like, con men will go to these incredible lengths and go through incredible difficulty to avoid working? It was a little bit like that with my dad. Like, he would his ingenuity in avoiding a trip to the emergency room was probably in many cases just as difficult as a trip to the emergency room would have been. But there was something that he took pride in. In kind of MacGyvering it in a way that avoided us having to go to the emergency room.
Well, Michael Schreiber, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
For me too, Terry. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Michael Schreiber's new collection of personal essays about being a father and a son is called Pops, Fatherhood in Pieces.